The Founding Fathers, American Revolution, our Constitution, our history, America. Thanks so much for tuning in as we discuss the people, places, events, and battles that turned 13 separate colonies into the greatest nation on earth, the United States.
Hello and welcome to this week's show. We're glad to have you here. We are going to discuss the background of the colonies themselves and the people that live there and the people that came to America from England. We want to make sure that you have an idea of what it was like living back then, who lived in these colonies, why they came over, and get a real sense of who these people were. They each had families, they had dreams. We just don't want to group them into those people. So we're going to try to delve into that a little bit today. So why did they come over here? Well, economic appeal was probably the largest reason that most risked their lives leaving England and coming to North America. Most colonists came to the New World and they encountered hard work, and they also had fun things like debilitating and deadly diseases, exposure, starving to death, and if you survived all of that, then you had to worry and be on the lookout and constant guard for Indian attacks. And let's not forget the long and dangerous ocean voyage, which in itself was rather treacherous. So with all of those wonderful things in the future of these travelers, why do you think they would risk it? Well, I feel that most colonists took the risk because staying where they were in England, the conditions and the opportunity were actually worse. Now, they had their own diseases too, but England was always in a war. The British Empire expansion was huge. It was similar to that of Rome. If you know your history back then, Rome pretty much was on every continent and the Roman Empire. And so the British Empire were kind of dispersed everywhere, and it always seemed like they were in war. Also, you know, they didn't have much of a future if they remained in England. And all of those wars and things like that took a toll economically for the average person. And it also took all the sons, not all, but a lot of the sons, brothers, husbands gone for periods of times. And sadly, many of them didn't come back from the war. So that's what I think the reasons of why people would come over here to North America. Now, if you're lucky enough to survive and thrive in the colonies, you would also have a much better chance to obtain your own land. So owning land was the big thing, kind of like it is today, right? Nothing's changed there. But owning land in Europe was virtually impossible. England is an island, and it's small, and there's only so much land to go around. Most of the land was already owned by royalty, the government, and the elite. And just for perspective, England is about 50,000 square miles. So if you picture the state of Mississippi or the state of Louisiana, that's how big England is. So like Hawaii, there's only so much land to go around. So owning land really provided a future for farming and prosperity and passing that down to your kids and generations. But owning land was not going to happen in England for the vast majority. Now, North America in the 1700s was populated by European colonists, and the economy here was growing at an amazing rate. The success of each colony and the colonies collectively would eventually be part of the reason for the war, but we'll talk about that topic in the near future. One thing, regardless of why they came, they had one thing in common. They all had to swear allegiance and loyalty to the King of England. This meant that you would submit to British law, taxes, and more. Now, you could keep your customs and language and the like, but you would have to agree to obey the King of England and consider England being your home country. Not all of the colonists in the 13 colonies were English. There were Germans and Swedes, Scottish, Irish, and practicing Catholicism, you know, being a Catholic was illegal both in the colonies and England, which seems interesting to me. So we kind of delved into it. The main and only religion in England was called the Church of England. One interesting fact is that colonists were required to pay taxes to support the Church of England. Once they were paid, colonists could go somewhere else. They could practice their Protestant faith or whatever they wanted to practice, but only if you paid taxes or tithes to the Church of England. Oh, and by the way, if you didn't go to church, that meant you were not paying your taxes. They would come find you and ensure your bill was brought current. If you still didn't pay the tax, you could go to jail and even be put in the stockades. During a trip to Colonial Williamsburg, at the courthouse there, they have some stockades where you put your head and your hands through, and you go, oh, it's a great photo op, and it's kind of cool to see that, but it's not a pleasant thing. And people would stay there for hours, days, even multiple days, and all from not going to church to pay your taxes. Can you imagine if that took place today? England really didn't care if you sat in the pews, but they did care if you were not paying taxes. It was basically a requirement. So you have to wonder, were they really serious about people attending church and worshiping and hearing the word of God, or were they just interested in money? I'll let you decide, but I'm thinking maybe a little bit of both, but mostly I think they wanted the money. So if you paid the tax, you really had religious freedom, which really was varied greatly among the colonies. So basically, it was the economic appeal that was probably the strongest incentive for new colonists to make the journey. And that is not to say that once you arrived, you've made it, right? Hey, I hit the beach. I'm going to be rich. Usually the work was difficult. You had to get accustomed to a new country, new settings, new people, and things didn't come easy just because you were lucky enough to have made the trip. Here's a side note. I don't know, maybe you know this, but if you don't, it's kind of cool. We oftentimes use the word England or United Kingdom or the UK interchangeably, and like that's all one and the same, but there is a difference. The UK is a nation made up of four territories, which is England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and of course, England being the largest. That is different. If you didn't know that, now you do. The risk of coming to America, and we've only listed a few, was worth it. I mean, the risks were worth coming here because they saw arriving in America as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity with the option of success and owning land being a real possibility. So other people that lived here were indentured servants and slaves. An indentured servant would last typically 2 to 7 years. At that time, or after they've completed those years of service, they would become a free person, be able to start their own life in the New World. In fact, nearly half of all immigrants to the colonies were indentured servants. There are distinct differences between indentured servants and slaves, but most lean towards slavery being more difficult. Fact is, though, both were very difficult, but slavery was forever, and being an indentured servant usually was temporary. Pretty much both sucked, and in many cases, being a servant was worse than slavery, if you can imagine that. So indentured servant, what that meant was you would be under someone's care and somebody would pay for your trip to come over. But in doing so, you would have to work for that person to pay off those fees. Basically, they get free labor. to pay your trip over here. Indentured servants were less of a financial commitment than slavery, so if you had an extremely dangerous or hazardous task, that oftentimes went to an indentured servant rather than a slave. Indentured servants could not leave their masters no matter what, and they could not marry or do anything of major importance without the blessing of their master. And like slavery, being whipped or physically hurt for not obeying also took place for them. Many indentured servants did not enter that service voluntarily. Some had the option to enter instead of prison or punishment for a crime. Others were simply kidnapped and sold into servitude, similar to the slaves. But like anything, people had mixed experiences with indentured servitude, and as with slavery, there were different experiences with that as well. For some, it was almost like being adopted into a family, where you work for a few years and then you move on. And for others, it was worse than slavery. Who you got, who kidnapped you, who paid your way over, was kind of basically a matter of luck. One of the most famous indentured servants, and oftentimes people don't know this, was, anybody know? Benjamin Franklin. Say what? One of our most famous founding fathers, an amazing guy, was an indentured servant. So at the age of 12, in 1718, he was indentured to his much older brother for 9 years. Now, he was also only supposed to receive wages on the final year. So you work 8 years for free, ninth year, he's going to pay you. That sounds like a pretty sweet deal, doesn't it? But just 5 years into his indentured servantry, his term, Benjamin Franklin ran to Philadelphia and started working as a printer. So when I was researching this topic, if you look through a lot of articles and documents, it says that Benjamin Franklin worked for his brother, or Benjamin Franklin worked as a printer with his brother, but that's not anything close to the truth. He was indentured by his brother, name was James, who berated him. He was abusive, and he even beat on Benjamin Franklin. Now, Benjamin Franklin's older brother, James, he owned a printing press. He actually published the New England Courant, which was one of the oldest and first independent newspapers in Boston. So being independent back then was kind of rare, and he was one of the first newspapers to do so, which brought some challenges, kind of like what we're experiencing today a little bit. So the Courant was considered controversial, and he, James, was imprisoned for a month in 1722. The reasoning for that was he was writing scandalous libel, is what they quoted. The paper was suppressed in 1727, and James and his wife, I think her name was Anne, don't quote me on that, but he and his wife left Boston that same year. So having your voice and opinion suppressed, deleted, suspended, does that sound familiar to anybody on what's happening today with social media and things like that? I wanted to know what the scandalous libel was. So I did some further research, and apparently it was because he wrote an article that implied that the colonial government was lax when it came to apprehending pirates. That was it. He basically said, you know, our government, our colonial government's not taking care of the pirates, and that's a big deal. And we'll cover in future shows what pirating meant, how it affected the colonies and all that. But that's his opinion. He said, you know, we're not arresting these pirates, and it has an adverse effect for shipping and trade and everything and for all people. So the colonial government said, you know what, we don't want to hear it. And they pretty much shut down his newspaper in 1727. I'm pretty confident that we're going to have a whole show or shows dedicated to Benjamin Franklin, but I wanted to find out if you have ever heard of the Silence Do-Good letters. Pretty famous. This was in the National Treasure series. But Mrs. Silence Do Good was the pen name used by Benjamin Franklin to get his work published in his brother's newspaper, the New England Courant. That wasn't his first attempt to get published. He wrote several things to get published, and he was denied every time. But when he tried to publish the letters under a female, Mrs. Silence Do Good, they were printed in the newspaper, and it became rather successful. And you can read all of the Silence Do Good letters. And we're going to have all of our show notes in our broadside, which is our blog on our website. And they're going to be broken down by episode. So you just look at the episode number or the title, and we will have those links for you. So if you want to dig deeper or actually see some of the real letters, we'll have those available to you. So now we're going to go into the slave portion. So we just got done talking about the indentured servants. So they made up a large part of who lived here in the colonies back then. All right, now we're going to go into slavery. African immigrants arrived almost exclusively as slaves. And there were some early Africans who were treated as indentured servants. And even a handful who arrived as free men, most of them worked as sailors or on ships. But the overwhelming majority arrived here as slaves. Many were sold into slavery in Africa due to not being able to pay a debt, a crime. They were captured in war. But bottom line is, all slaves were reduced to property for life. And if you had any children during your lifetime, they too would become slaves. And the history, the details, the atrocity of slavery are widely known, so I don't think it's important to delve into all of the details, but we'll probably go a little more in depth in future shows. But relating to the American Revolution, slavery did exist, and they would be an important part in the fighting portion of the war, and choosing what side to be on for the slaves. Should I side with the colonists? Should I side with the British? It really depended on which side looked best for them to gain their freedom. So again, we're going to delve deep into this topic in the future. But I will talk about this. I'm often asked, how can I can be so enamored and revere George Washington since he owned slaves? In a very brief explanation, slavery was as common back then as it is having a Facebook account today. It doesn't make it right, but you have to put history into perspective, and you cannot put what happened in history in today's world, whether you're talking about slavery or any other topic for that matter. It was a different time. We're talking 200 plus years ago. We're not justifying it by any means, but you can't say, well, what happened back then? You know, if this was happening today, well, you can't do that. The laws were different and all of that. The last thing I'm going to say on George Washington owning slaves in this show is that when he was born and his father died, he inherited several slaves. And then his half-brother died. He inherited even more slaves. Then eventually he married Martha Custis, the richest woman in all of the country or all of the colonies. He inherited even more. So he had 100-plus slaves without any choice. That was just the way it was back then. And what most people don't know is that if you did own slaves and one day said, you know what, I don't agree with slavery, I think it's wrong, I am going to allow all my slaves to go free, this wasn't even an option. And to my understanding, it was against the law to let all of your slaves free. You could, by law, release one slave per year. Well, that's great, except if you own hundreds of slaves, the chances of you living 300 years to release all your slaves obviously isn't going to cut it. This was relayed to me about the one slave per year during a trip either to Jamestown, Mount Vernon, or another historical site. So I wanted to find the actual document or laws from the time claiming this. I could not find it. But that's what I've been told, but I'm actually going to keep digging deeper. So once I find that, I will let you guys know. The other group, folks that lived here were Native Americans. And they controlled large portions of the colonies, as well as a lot of the land to the west. Once the Indians became aware of the war, or the impending war, they didn't really have any strong loyalty to the colonists or the British. Why are they called Indians, right? Sometimes people think that's a derogatory name. The term Indian was given by Europeans because they thought they were landing in the Indies. And so when they saw people living there, they said, these are Indians because we've arrived in the Indies. Well, they actually were arriving in America. But that's why they're called Indians. And over the years, many words and descriptions have become a hot button or considered politically incorrect, such as the word Indian. If we use the term Indian, it's generic and not meant to be a disparaging way. And certainly, nor is it used with negative intentions. We spent a couple weeks at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota and worked with kids of their reservation. And so we are very adamant in helping and working with Native Americans. So I asked some of them. They don't care, or the ones I spoke to really weren't offended by the word Indian. But anyway, with that background, if I fail to say Native Americans and I say Indian, just know I'm not doing it in a negative way. Plus, when we talk about the colonies in future shows and I say the Native, that might be confusing because I'm not really talking about Native American Indians. I'm talking about the Native colonial people that live there. So anyway, I'll stop rambling on that. But we are going to talk about what type of tribes, who they sided with in the war, and how important they were in the French and Indian War in future episodes. So they were way important in the French and Indian War, and as well as the American Revolution. So be looking forward to learning about that. It's pretty fascinating. And it all makes more sense once you know the groups and the different people involved and how it all comes together. So you have all these pieces of the puzzle scattered on the table, and they all have their particular part to come together to paint a picture or a puzzle. And so that's why we're kind of talking about all of these groups and type of people. The colonial regions, so the 13 colonies, they were broken down into three regions: the New England, the Middle Colonies, and the Southern Colonies. For many decades, the British government allowed the colonies to grow and pretty much do anything they wanted. They allowed them to make their own laws and run themselves, really kind of had a hands-off approach. They really didn't interfere at all. But when Britain came back in to kind of get more taxes added and take control of things more, it wasn't a real good decision. So it would be similar to today, having a business owner leave the business and like totally walk away and take a hands-off approach, maybe check in once a year. And then after decades, this business is doing incredibly well. It's booming and everybody's happy and the employees are managing themselves. And then the owner comes in and tries to change everything, rework the processes, tax the employees, get involved with the day-to-day operation. That would not work. And that's kind of what Britain did. They left them alone. They flourished. And then they were getting more involved, which caused issues. And that turns into the Stamp Act and a whole slew of other things that we are going to cover. And it's pretty exciting. So I'll have a link to a map of the 13 colonies. The New England colonies, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Maine at the time was part of Massachusetts. The middle colonies, Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York. And then the southern colonies was Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. So basically, all of our history and the forming of our country was all on the East Coast. So it's a great place to visit, let me tell you. timber, building ships, farming, shops, a lot of different trades such as blacksmith, silversmith, and others. They flourished in New England and some of the middle colonies, but cash crops were king in the southern colonies. The colonial families would keep small farms to provide food for them and their family, and every family member shared in the work. So the men planted crops, they mended the fences and the house, and they went hunting and butchered livestock, fished to feed their family. The women oftentimes would milk the cows, gather eggs, and preserve food for the winter. When they raised their children, everybody worked as a team, but the men did one thing and the women did the other. So the women would also cook and sew clothes. They would also make soap and candles, which was pretty darn important considering you couldn't walk into your house and flip a switch. Boys worked with their fathers and girls helped their moms. The areas, at least in New England, the area's cold climate and rocky landscape made farming, at least large scale, pretty tough. And so many of the people in New England made a living through trade, seafaring, fishing. They also used lumber from the abundant forest to build ships. So shipbuilding was huge for not only selling, but for fishing. And they would trade with Europe and Africa and the West Indies. And eventually, the New Englanders eventually gave up on all agriculture. And then they started raising livestock instead. So meat products, fish, and lumber were probably the most valuable and key exports. In New England, the New England colonies, the land was divided among the settlers. As landowners, the free adult males participated in all the town meetings and made decisions for the community. But only a relatively small group of men dominated the colonial governments of New England, and that elite group consisted of men in super important and prominent, you know, occupations such as merchants, business owners, and lawyers. The center of New England's merchant elite was located in Boston, Massachusetts. It's a wonderful city. Been there a few times. It's so full and rich of American Revolution history. It's a great place to go. The middle colonies grew grains such as wheat, rye, oats, barley, and corn. The wheat could be ground for flour, and then both wheat and flour could be sold in the colonies or in Europe. And this really was the beginning of the melting pot. Different people from different lands with different customs, religions, ideas, and dreams. So the melting pot, as we all claim America to be, well, this is kind of how it started. So it's neat to dig in a little bit and see what the melting pot did and how they worked together and how they lived. The last region of the southern colonies included Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, and Georgia. Georgia was the last of the 13 to be established. The southern colonies were pretty much dominated by the desire to make money. They wanted to dominate the marketplace, which led to the development of large plantations and an agriculturally focused society. So when you have large plantations such as tobacco and cotton and things like that, you have to have a very large labor force. So much of the labor on the farms and the plantations was done by slaves brought over from Africa. So the other thing about all of the colonies is it was pretty rare that if you're in Georgia that you would not travel outside of your colony to Virginia. If you were in basically one state, you wouldn't go to another. In fact, they weren't states back then, but they would call their country by the state. So my country of Virginia, my country of New England, my country of, not New England, my country of Georgia. Every colony was very, I don't want to say isolated, but they didn't travel far from home, and it was very, very rare that they traveled into another country. I just found that to be pretty fascinating. Obviously, with travel being difficult, I could see some of that, but for people to remain in their country, as they would call them, and not go or visit or do anything outside of their home country, thought that was interesting. I suppose there's people in the United States now that don't travel outside their state, but I would think that would probably be the minority. And if you think about never leaving the state that you're in, and you consider, like, we're in Idaho, so if we considered Montana another country or Florida as another country, we probably wouldn't want to go to other countries. I'll just stay in my own country. Although with with what Texas is looking to do, maybe we will have another country in our country. Whew, I got confused on that. So on that note, next week we're going to cover what it was like living in England and kind of give an overview and happenings there. And again, I just want to relay that all of the links discussed in each episode is going to be located in our broadside on our website, which is patriotpowerpodcast.com. You can easily find them by episode and dig even deeper into whatever you want or whatever interests you. Our goal is to provide you with quality links that we have visited. We're not just collecting a list of a million links on a certain topic. We want to provide you with links that is packed full of accurate information and relatable to what the topics that we cover in our shows. Basically, quality over quantity as far as links and resources. So check out our broadside there. We really appreciate you tuning in this week. Next week, hopefully, I'll have my bride, Lisa, with me. And until next week, I hope that you have a wonderful day and that you and your family are blessed. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope that you tune in next week. Each show is going to drop one time per week. We're going to have some bonus episodes, so make sure you subscribe so you'll get notified when a new show is available. And all of our contact information is in the show notes, but everything that you possibly could need is on our website, patriotpowerpodcast.com.